Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Eric Patterson. Patterson is an associate professor of American Studies and American Literature at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. In addition to teaching courses on American culture, he also teaches regarding the history and culture of sexual gender minority people. He recently published an important and insightful new book called On Brokeback Mountain, Meditations about Masculinity, Fear, and Love in the Story and the Film, published by Lexington Books. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Hi, thanks.
Now, the film Brokeback Mountain came from the short story of the same name by writer Annie Proulx in her 1999 collection, Close Range, Wyoming Stories. Now, tell us how this story captured your imagination.
Well, I only read it, actually, in the fall of 2005. I'd heard about it. I have friends who are big Annie Proulx fans, and my partner, Terry Forbes, had read two books of hers. He'd read The Shipping News and what's the other one? That Old Ace in the Hole.
Mm.
And, you know, he really recommended her. He said she was really good. And I had been hearing that there was this good short story by her about two men who fell in love called Brokeback Mountain. And I just hadn't gotten around to reading it, and then began to hear that a movie was in the works from reading The Advocate magazine. So in the fall of 2005, Terry and I both read the story, and we just thought it was fantastic.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, I mean, we were floored by it. It was the kind of thing where I read it once, Terry read it the same day, then we both read it again a couple of days later, and we were talking about it a lot, and we just basically, our attitude was, how can they do a good movie out of a story, you know, that they'd mess up the story in the movie. I mean, there's always that fear. And then when the movie came to Ithaca in January of 2006, we went to see it again a couple of days later. And we talked about it so much, and I began writing down my ideas. At first, I thought I was going to write an article, and then I just felt possessed by it.
Oh, yeah. It's a compelling.
Within a couple of weeks, I was writing a book.
Yeah, it's an absolutely compelling story. Now, Brokeback really is one of the first, especially movies, that has spoken in such poetic terms about males falling in love with mm-hmm. each other. Talk to us a little bit about how profound that is, even now.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I really like about both the story and the movie is I think they locate the story outside of what a lot of people usually think of as the world of gay men. And in fact, I don't even really think it's appropriate to call the men in the story in the movie gay, because gay implies participation in a kind of consciousness and culture that often is urban. It isn't mm-hmm. always urban.
Mm-hmm.
But there's definitely a sort of gay subcultural community in America. And there are also a lot of men who are attracted to men who don't participate in that, who are outside of that. So I think the story and the movie were really important for showing that, as opposed to what the majority sort of assumes about gay men. I mean, I think there's a world of gay men in America, and I think there's also a mainstream stereotype about that world.
And that's the men in San Francisco partying.
Right, or Will and Grace, that kind
Will
of stuff, which,
yeah.
you know, I don't think it's all bad. I'm not trying to
yeah.
condemn those things. I think they have important effects, but I think Brokeback Mountain introduces us to a dimension of same-sex experience. I think there's a parallel for women as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But one thing that I really was deeply impressed with about both the story and the film is that they show what I think is the experience of a lot of men, especially when they're young, which is a kind of continuity between friendship and sexual attraction. I think it happens much, much more than anybody acknowledges, that young men who are friends sometimes become attracted to each other. Sometimes they can accept it, or one of them can accept it. Sometimes they can't. Sometimes both of them can accept it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's at least initially what happens in the story in the film.
And one of the things that happens in the film, and I'm referring to the film more because I'm sure more
yeah,
people
sure,
have seen it,
sure.
is the fact that so much stereotyping in this country about gay male relationships has to do with them just being sexual and not really having a connection
yeah.
or a friendship or
yeah.
even love.
Yeah.
So this is how profound this story
Yeah, I agree with you.
Is.
I mean, I think that's the first main chapter of my book is about friendship, and it seems to me that I mean, that's really something important that both the story and the movie do. They show that it isn't simply a matter of sexual attraction. I think this happens with sexual minorities generally, with gay men and lesbians and any person who experiences same-sex desire. I think the culture tends to only see the sexual component. And I mean, I point out to my students, you know, we'll be talking about the difference between sexual minorities, gender minorities, and straight people. And when people think of a straight man and a straight woman who are a couple, they don't immediately start thinking of the sex acts they're going to do. You know, when people go to a wedding and they see the wedding cake with the little bride and groom on the top of it, their first thought isn't like, you know, picturing them having sex and what kind of sex it's going to be. But with gay people, I mean, and I think it especially has to do with the contempt that a lot of straight men feel, not all straight men, but that a lot of straight men feel for male-male sexual intercourse. I think often what happens is gay men just turn into signifiers of sex for them. And I think that's a great aspect of Brokeback Mountain, that it makes it clear that it doesn't hide the sex. It's not afraid of the sex, but it also emphasizes the love.
And the intimacy.
Oh, yeah.
Which was so subtly done in that film. I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about how Prue, in her story as well as the film, has dared to take male love into what we consider of as the macho American West. Talk to us about that. You have a whole chapter about nature.
Oh, God, I probably would talk too much. I think it's very interesting what she's done. I mean, I think you could have written the kind of story that she's written about lots of different kinds of men, a story about men who fall in love but who are not what the dominant culture conventionally assumes to be gay. But she chose not to make them urban men or southern rural men or, you know, manual laborers in some modern industry or something like that. She chose to make them in some ways fit what Americans have constructed as a kind of ideal of masculinity, the cowboy.
Like the Marlboro man.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, the whole thing looks, you know, like a Western movie or a Marlboro commercial. I mean, substantial parts of it do. But I guess what strikes me, I mean, first of all, people need to notice, and I think thoughtful people do, that they aren't cowboys, they're sheep herders. And actually, in the American West, there's a kind of snobbery, I guess, on the part of cattle workers toward sheep workers. Sheep are sort of viewed in low esteem. But I think what she does is to construct a kind of masculinity where the majority least expects homosexuality.
Oh, absolutely.
And in fact, the Marlboro man masculinity ideal has been used as a kind of homophobic model. I mean, in fact, for most Americans, the idea of the cowboy sort of is inconceivable in relationship to homosexuality.
But we all know that the cowboy has been a big, big character in gay porn.
Yes.
So gay people were not taken aback by that.
Yeah, no, that's quite true. And I think, you know, because the cowboy is an archetype of masculinity, gay men for whom that kind of sort of hyper-butch masculinity really appeals, they, you know, they've used that as an image a lot over the last 50 or 60 years. Although I also think if you look closely at mainstream representations of the cowboy in fiction and art and film in Westerns, there are strong elements of homoeroticism that often either go unnoticed or sort of partly acknowledged. And I think in some ways what Brokeback Mountain does is to point out that the American national fantasy of masculinity about the cowboy actually contains within it a really strong theme of homoeroticism. So
surprise, surprise.
It's a good thing John Wayne's dead.
Now, let's talk more about this role of nature and how it plays in the story. Living apart from society, a sense of freedom. Most same-sex couples don't even have to think about this. I mean, most opposite-sex couples don't have to even think about safety and being able to be open in their relationship. Talk to us a little bit more about how nature has played such a role in this.
Sure. Well, I think, and this is, you know, hardly an original idea with me, but this is something that people thinking about same-sex relationships for men and for women have pointed out repeatedly, which is that public space is experienced very differently for same-sex people relationships than it is for opposite sex people in opposite sex relationships. The whole world is basically affirming to opposite sex relationships with advertising, television, movies, just imagery everywhere. There are images of opposite sex love everywhere, and some of them are very exalted. Some of them are, you know, much more sexy and pornographic, that kind of thing. But as I think most lesbian or gay or bisexual people will agree, public displays of affection are risky, even in a place like Chelsea in Manhattan or the Castro in San Francisco or someplace like that. But in a lot of America, two men or two women simply can't publicly display their affection safely. And I think that's a major theme of both the story and the movie, the danger of public space. Mm-hmm. And so what Annie Proulx did, and I think the movie does, it's very interesting. Usually in the American Western tradition, the landscape, the heroic landscape of the Rockies and the West, is represented as a place that the cowboy hero is in the process of conquering for society. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what the story in the movie does do is to completely reverse that and to present the mountain as a refuge from society, mm-hmm. Although it's not a completely secure refuge, because even there the man can be seen by Joe Aguirre through his binoculars.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of the story, too. You actually have a chapter titled, We Do That in the Wrong Place and We'll Be Dead, and that's a line from the book. But let's talk about danger in the gay landscape, in the gay, lesbian, bisexual landscape. Even in wide open spaces, gay and lesbian people are not safe.
Yeah, I mean, visibility, I think, I mean, it's changing, and sexual gender minority people are becoming more visible, I think, and it takes a lot of courage for them to do it. But, you know, just less than a month ago in California, at a public school, the day before Valentine's Day, a little 14-year-old boy was sitting in class, and another boy who apparently resented the fact that the other boy had stated that he was gay, and perhaps there are different stories about this, perhaps had expressed affection for the other boy. This other boy came up behind him and executed him. He shot him in the back of the head in an English class. And it is, I mean, there are a lot of differences between racism and homophobia. But I think public murders of that kind, they do function in a way like lynching, in that they don't just kill one person, they affect millions of people. There are many other children who are in schools who've seen stories about that and who know they have to be careful.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eric Patterson. He's the author of On Brokeback Mountain, Meditations About Masculinity, Fear, and Love in the Story and Film. I want to go back to the danger thing,
sure.
Because there is danger even in gay bars, as we know by what happened to Matthew Shepard, who met these guys in the gay bar.
Yeah, actually, I don't think it was actually a gay bar. I think I'd have to go back and check, but I think Laramie didn't actually have a, you know, real gay bar. It was more like a bar that kind of had a reputation as having some gay clientele, which often is the case in real remote rural areas.
Oh,
that it's not like an actual gay, lesbian-only place. It's more like a mixed, you know, we'll sort of tolerate you.
That's the way this whole culture was prior to Stonewall.
Yeah,
in fact.
Absolutely.
You know, the bars with the black curtains and so on. Now, let's talk a little bit about visibility, though, in regard to this story. Do you think a story like this would make people more afraid to come out? Or how do you think this affected people who really are afraid?
Well, there has been, I mean, from what I have followed in the press, there has been a big response to it. I mean, there's a lot of testimony from, and Annie Proulx herself has said this, there's been a lot of testimony from people who have seen the movie or read the story and who feel like it speaks to them about their experience. So I think in a sense, it brings forward people who have experienced the danger of visibility and who've been the targets of violence. But at the same time, I'm sure it does. You know, there are people whose fears of being visible and whose efforts to pass for straight are reinforced by knowing about violence of that kind.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Now, Annie Proulx wrote this story because of the damage to sexual minorities by homophobia. I mean, that's what she attested to.
Right.
Do you think this is helpful for people who are still afraid to come out?
I hope so. I'm sure. I mean, I think back to when I was afraid to come out a long time ago, and the fear is so damaging, and it's so, I think, thoughtful straight people get it, and I think there really are allies, and I think those include people like Annie Proulx and Ang Lee and Larry McMurtry and Diana Ossana and Jake Gyllenhaal and Heath Ledger and others. But I think most straight people who aren't trying to be allies just don't get how damaging trying to pass for straight is, how the internal psychological and spiritual damage it does. So I think for people who are in that phase of their lives, I can see how it would be frightening. I mean, I'm sure there are people I imagine there are men who've watched Brokeback Mountain on cable when their wives or their girlfriends were out. You know, they had to, you know, to watch Brokeback Mountain in the closet is quite a thought. but my heart goes out to them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, during the time frame when Brokeback takes place, it's supposed to be the early 60s.
Right.
Pre-Stonewall, obviously.
Right.
This is when homosexuality was thought of as a mental illness.
Right.
So this story is quite profound that these guys could even, you know, in that context, even make contact with each other
right.
outside of Brokeback Mountain.
Right.
Yeah.
The movie and story are interesting because they don't specifically allude to either of the major negative constructions of homosexuality. There's no point where Ennis and Jack talk about how people think their relationship is sick or crazy or something like that. And at least in the story, there's really no reference to homophobic religion either. One of the things that really interests me about the movie is that in, I think, very perceptive and subtle ways, the movie implies that one of the sources of tension between Ennis and Alma, his wife, after she sees Ennis and Jack hugging and kissing, that one of the sources of tension may be a religious difference. There are subtle indications that she likes to go to church, that he doesn't like to go to church with what he calls in the movie the fire and brimstone crowd. And I think there is at least the suggestion that maybe she uses religion. She can't speak to him directly about his sexuality, but she kind of provokes him by making them go to church or something like that. But generally, I think the movie and the story are quite subtle. They don't address directly the sources of homophobia, but they make it very clear how deeply connected it is to masculinity. And for thoughtful people, I think they know that negative construction of homosexuality was being fed and supported by both religion and psychology. Mm-hmm. But the movie and the story don't hit you over the head with that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, particularly Ennis in this story, a lot of men end up in short-term relationships, not even relationships, encounters.
Mm.
Now, let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, Ennis was obviously the one that wasn't very comfortable in this story.
More uncomfortable.
Yeah. Especially in regard to having a long-term relationship.
Yeah. No, I think both the characters are presented as being, I mean, neither of them, I think, is ever fully out. I think, in a way, Jack is presented as moving toward being more accepting of his sexual identity in the sense that he, of the two, he's willing to have a relationship where he lives with another man, and if that becomes visible to people, so be it. I mean, that's an aspect of visibility that a lot of straight people, I think, aren't aware of, that for two men or two women to decide to live together in this society basically outs them. So, you know, whereas the society really supports and reinforces a husband and wife in all sorts of ways, the more visible a same-sex couple becomes, the more dangerous it is in some ways, more possibility of shunning or harassment or even violence. Mm-hmm. I think Jack's more willing to risk that. Ennis is less willing to risk it. On the other hand, when they have their reunion 4 years after having first met, Ennis makes it quite clear that, you know, he's glad Jack came back and he wants to see him again, but he vetoes the idea of living together. So I think it's sort of Ennis who sets the terms of it being an occasional relationship that has to be invisible.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Annie Proulx she wrote this story in 1999?
97.
97.
Yeah.
Do you think the reason why she set this story in the early 60s is significant? Is she speaking to the fact that there still are people who are so afraid to come out?
I think the time setting of the story does a number of things. One thing it does, I mean, you know, it's sort of unavoidable as you read the story if you know a bit, as you do and I do, about the history of sexual gender minorities in America. It's unavoidable to sort of think, gee, what was going on in America at this time? And what was going on was the public emergence of a gay and lesbian rights movement. And, you know, mm-hmm. Jack and Ennis aren't affected by it. I mean, it kind of makes that point. And it also clearly locates their relationship at a time when, as you said before, the sickness model was still very clearly in place. The homophobic religious voices were becoming even louder. And so, in a way, you kind of watch Ennis and Jack develop their relationship. And I think one thing the time frame does is to emphasize how isolated they are, mm-hmm. how little support they have, how little, you know, they have nobody to talk to. Mm-hmm. And it's Jack as well. I mean, there's an interesting episode in the movie, which is absent in the story, in which Jack goes to a straight bar, a country and western bar, and he kind of awkwardly tries to make his interest or his friendliness to another guy who's a rodeo clown to make that evident. And the other guy picks up on something he doesn't like and kind of gives Jack a cold shoulder and turns away, and then you can see he's talking about Jack. And that's a risk. I mean, I know from my own experience when I was trying to pass as a high school student and college student and graduate student, that there were always these situations where you'd get to know someone and hope for a friendship and maybe even hope it would be more than that. And then there would come a moment when the other guy sort of figured out from his perspective that something was wrong, you know, mm. you were too friendly, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I think that speaks to a kind of experience of somebody who's afraid to go to a gay bar or afraid to go to the kind of, in the 1960s when that part of the movie is set, afraid to go to a public park or a theater or someplace where guys cruised one another. So, you know, Ennis is very isolated, but I think Jack's presented as being pretty isolated, too.
Oh, absolutely.
And as Proulx says, they both, in one of her interviews, she says they aren't actually cowboys, they're ranch hands, and they're deeply enamored of the great American myth of the cowboy. I mean, they themselves are drawn into this ideal that Americans have developed of masculinity. And as a result, I think she's suggesting how hard it would be for them to go to the kinds of places where guys could meet guys in those days, whether a gay bar or a public park or something like mm-hmm. that, because it would cancel out their masculinity. Mm-hmm. In the mm-hmm. story, there's a great line when they have their reunion, when Ennis says to Jack, "I don't want to be like them guys you see around sometimes." And it's very clear from that, I think, that he knows there are guys who are seen as queers, who people hate, and who basically have forfeited their masculinity in a homophobic society. Mm-hmm. And I think especially for the kind of men that that Prue is depicting for working men who don't own much property, who've grown up very poor, and possibly in Ennis's case, who are of a mixed race background. That's never said, but his last name at least very subtly suggests that he might be part Hispanic. And for men with those backgrounds, one of the very few sources of status they have in our society is their masculinity. Mm. Jack's white, I mean, that's pretty clear, you know, and of an Anglo background. And so he has race and masculinity in a racist and homophobic society. But Ennis may not even, you know, in a racist society, have the status that the society gives to whiteness, which is a kind of interesting, I mean, it's real subtle. It's never said explicitly.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think this story, especially the film version, which more people obviously probably saw, do you think it changed any hearts and minds in regard to homophobia and in the way the culture treats, especially males, and the whole masculine issue?
Hmm. Yeah, I think probably. I mean, clearly there was a real big public response to it. Lots of fans, lots of discussion of it, lots of articles. It's been widely watched, widely read. I just hope it reached people. I hope it reached the people who needed to be reached. I think gay and lesbian people responded pretty positively to it, and bisexual people. And I think people who aspire to be allies responded strongly to it. On the other hand, when you look at the news stories and the internet, the homophobic organizations were furious about it. They see it as part of a conspiracy by gay people in Hollywood to, they call it homosexual propaganda. And, you know, I mean, they're really extreme, I think, deranged homophobic groups like Fred Phelps,
preacher who
so-called minister, who tried to disrupt the funeral of Heath Ledger, and, you know, who say that Heath Ledger is in hell because he was in the movie. I mean, the ugliness of that stuff is just, it's unspeakable.
Mm-hmm. So you think this was maybe one step?
Well, I think it's sort of like the gay marriage issue. I think it makes the boundaries clearer. It's an issue, it's a kind of polarizing issue. It forces people to take sides, which I think probably is good, because it causes sexual minority, gender minority people to speak up, and it forces straight people to think about their situation and perhaps to become allies, or it reveals who the real bigots are. I mean, with somebody like Bush, you know, Bush was asked at a news conference whether he had seen it and, you know, responded with some kind of, you know, embarrassed, dismissive comment. You know, I mean, it's not as if anybody had any illusions about Bush, but it forces these people to show what they are, to show just how bigoted and uncaring and homophobic they are.
Eric Patterson, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah.
And I do recommend this book. It's a fascinating book. Again, it's called On Brokeback Mountain, Meditations About Masculinity, Fear and Love in the Story and Film. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.